Here's another recent change in our civil liberties. Now, if it wants to, the federal government has the right to monitor every website you go to on the internet, keep a list of everyone you send email to or receive email from, and everyone you call on the telephone or who calls you, and they don't even have to show probable cause that you've done anything wrong. Nor do they have to report ever to any court on what they're doing with the information. Moreover, there are precious few safeguards in the system they've set up to keep them from reading the content of all your email. Now, is everybody fine with that? What about this next change? For America's first 212 years, it used to be that if the police wanted to search your house, they had to be able to convince an independent judge to give them a search warrant. And then, with rare exceptions, they had to go and bang on your door and yell, "Open up!" And then if you didn't quickly open up, they could knock the door down. And then if they seized anything, also, they had to leave a list explaining what they had taken. That way, if it was all a terrible mistake, as it sometimes is, you could go and get your stuff back. But that's all changed now. Starting 2 years ago, federal agents were given broad new statutory authority by the Patriot Act to sneak and peek in non-terrorism cases. In other words, they can secretly enter your home with no warning, whether you're there or not, and they can wait for months before telling you that they were there. They can copy stuff or alter stuff, take stuff. It doesn't have to have any relationship to terrorism whatsoever. It applies to any garden variety crime. Here's another one. What about the right to consult a lawyer if you're arrested? That seems like it's pretty important. But Attorney General Ashcroft has issued regulations authorizing the secret monitoring of attorney-client conversations on his own say-so without any prior judicial review, and that's been required in the past, in the rare instances when it was permitted in the past. So now, whoever is taken into custody really has to assume that the government is listening to their conversations with their lawyers. Now, does it matter if the government listens in on everything you say to your lawyer? Is that okay? Well, let's take another change. And thanks to the librarians, more people know about this one. The FBI now has the right to go into any library and ask for the records of everybody who's used the library and get a list of who is reading what. Similarly, the FBI can demand all the records of banks, colleges, hotels, hospitals, credit card companies, and a lot of other companies. And these changes are only the beginning. There are more on the way. Just last week, Attorney General Ashcroft issued more brand new guidelines. These to permit the FBI to run credit checks and background checks and gather other information about anyone who is of investigatory interest, that's the phrase, meaning anyone who the agent thinks is suspicious without any evidence of criminal behavior being involved at all. Is that fine with everybody? See, I think people in the country looking at these changes sort of feel that way too. And I really do believe so. I believe that the Patriot Act has turned out to be, on balance, a terrible mistake, and that it became a kind of Tonkin Gulf resolution conferring Congress's blessing for this president's assault on civil liberties. Therefore, I believe strongly that the few good measures of this law should be passed again in a new and smaller law, but the Patriot Act should be repealed. And I hope you'll help convince Congress to repeal the Patriot Act as a first step to protecting our freedom.
Welcome back to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with Mario Cuomo's keynote speech at the 1984 Democratic National Convention. Mario Cuomo is an American politician and member of the Democratic Party. He was the governor of New York for 3 terms from 1983 to 1994. In this speech, he explains his view of liberal politics. And then after that, Why Wall Street Rules with Gretchen Morgenson. Gretchen C. Morgenson is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who writes the Market Watch column for the Money and Business section of the New York Times. She's interviewed by Chris Martinson. And then after that, Robert Byrd's Iraq speech, The Arrogance of Power. Robert Byrd was a U.S. Senator from 1959 to 2010. He represented West Virginia. He was the longest serving senator and the longest serving member in the history of the United States Congress.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the great Empire State and the whole family of New York, let me thank you for the great privilege of being able to address this convention. Please allow me to skip the stories and the poetry and the temptation to deal in nice but vague rhetoric. Let me instead use this valuable opportunity to deal immediately with the questions that should determine this election and that we all know are vital to the American people. 10 days ago, President Reagan admitted that although some people in this country seem to be doing well nowadays, others were unhappy, even worried about themselves, their families, and their futures. The president said that he didn't understand that fear. He said, "Why, this country is a shining city on a hill." And the president is right. In many ways, we are a shining city on a hill. But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. A shining city is perhaps all the president sees from the portico of the White House and the veranda of his ranch, where everyone seems to be doing well. But there's another city. There's another part to the shining city, the part where some people can't pay their mortgages, and most young people can't afford one, where students can't afford the education they need, and middle-class parents watch the dreams they hold for their children evaporate. In this part of the city, there are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it. Even worse, there are elderly people who tremble in the basements of the houses there. And there are people who sleep in the city's streets, in the gutter, where the glitter doesn't show. There are ghettos where thousands of young people without a job or an education give their lives away to drug dealers every day. There is despair, Mr. President, in the faces that you don't see, in the places that you don't visit, in your shining city. In fact, Mr. President, this is a nation. Mr. President, you ought to know that this nation is more a tale of two cities than it is just a shining city on a hill. Maybe, Mr. President, if you visited some more places, maybe if you went to Appalachia where some people still live in sheds, maybe if you went to Lackawanna where thousands of unemployed steel workers wonder why we subsidize foreign steel. Maybe, Mr. President, if you stopped in at a shelter in Chicago and spoke to the homeless there. Maybe, Mr. President, if you asked a woman who had been denied the help she needed to feed her children because you said you needed the money for a tax break for a millionaire or for a missile we couldn't afford to use. Maybe, Mr. President, but I'm afraid not. Because the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, that this is how we were warned it would be. President Reagan told us from the very beginning that he believed in a kind of social Darwinism, survival of the fittest. Government can't do everything, we were told, so it should settle for taking care of the strong and hope that economic ambition and charity will do the rest. Make the rich richer, and what falls from the table will be enough for the middle class and those who are trying desperately to work their way into the middle class. You know, the Republicans called it trickle-down when Hoover tried it. Now they call it supply side, but it's the same shining city for those relative few who are lucky enough to live in its good neighborhoods. But for the people who are excluded, for the people who are locked out, all they can do is stare from a distance at that city's glimmering towers. It's an old story. It's as old as our history. The difference between Democrats and Republicans has always been measured in courage and confidence.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
As we reap what we have sown, from the slaughter of the Indians to Hitler's Holocaust, dinosaurs to world wars and lives forever lost. Some may call that evolution or cosmic retribution. Yeah, we still create more new enemies. When there's a peaceful resolution on the brink of revolution, sing now or forever hold.
The Republicans believe that the wagon train will not make it to the frontier unless some of the old, some of the young, some of the weak are left behind by the side of the trail. The strong, they tell us, will inherit the land. We Democrats believe in something else. We Democrats believe that we can make it all the way with the whole family intact, and we have more than once. Ever since Franklin Roosevelt lifted himself from his wheelchair to lift this nation from its knees, wagon train after wagon train to new frontiers of education, housing, peace, the whole family aboard, constantly reaching out to extend and enlarge that family, lifting them up into the wagon on the way, blacks and Hispanics and people of every ethnic group and Native Americans, all those struggling to build their families and claim some small share of America. For nearly 50 years, we carry them all to new levels of comfort and security and dignity, even affluence. And remember this, some of us in this room today are here only because this nation had that kind of confidence. and it would be wrong to forget that. So here we are at this convention to remind ourselves where we come from and to claim the future for ourselves and for our children. Today, our great Democratic Party, which has saved this nation from depression, from fascism, from racism, from corruption, is called upon to do it again. This time to save the nation from confusion and division, from the threat of eventual fiscal disaster, and most of all, from the fear of a nuclear holocaust. That's not going to be easy. Mo Udall is exactly right, it won't be easy. And in order to succeed, we must answer our opponents' polished and appealing rhetoric with a more telling reasonableness and rationality. We must win this case on the merits. We must get the American public to look past the glitter, beyond the showmanship, to the reality, the hard substance of things. And we'll do it not so much with speeches that sound good, as with speeches that are good and sound, not so much with speeches that will bring people to their feet, as with speeches that will bring people to their senses. We must make the American people hear our tale of two cities. We must convince them that we don't have to settle for two cities, that we can have one city, indivisible, shining for all of its people. Now, we will have no chance to do that if what comes out of this convention is a babble of arguing voices. If that's what's heard throughout the campaign, dissonant sounds from all sides, we will have no chance to tell our message. To succeed, we will have to surrender some small parts of our individual interests to build a platform that we can all stand on at once and comfortably, proudly singing out, we need a platform we can all agree to, so that we can sing out the truth for the nation to hear in chorus. Its logic so clear and commanding that no slick Madison Avenue commercial, no amount of geniality, no martial music will be able to muffle the sound of the truth. And we Democrats must unite. We Democrats must unite so that the entire nation can unite, because surely the Republicans won't bring this country together. Their policies divide the nation into the lucky and the left out, into the royalty and the rabble. The Republicans are willing to treat that division as victory. They would cut this nation in half, into those temporarily better off and those worse off than before, and they would call that division recovery. Now, we should not be embarrassed or dismayed or chagrined if the process of unifying is difficult, even wrenching at times. Remember that unlike any other party, we embrace men and women of every color, every creed, every orientation, every economic class. In our family are gathered everyone from the abject poor of Essex County in New York to the enlightened affluent of the Gold Coast at both ends of the nation. And in between is the heart of our constituency, the middle class, the people not rich enough to be worry-free, but not poor enough to be on welfare. The middle class, those people who work for a living because they have to, not because some psychiatrist told them it was a convenient way to fill the interval between birth and eternity. White collar and blue collar, young professionals, men and women in small business, desperate for the capital and contracts that they need to prove their worth. We speak for the minorities who have not yet entered the mainstream. We speak for ethnics who want to add their culture to the magnificent mosaic that is America. We speak for women who are indignant that this nation refuses to etch into its governmental commandments the simple rule, thou shalt not sin against equality. A rule so simple. I was going to say, and I perhaps dare not, but I will. It's a commandment so simple it can be spelled in three letters. E-R-A. We speak for young people demanding an education and a future. We speak for senior citizens. We speak for senior citizens who are terrorized by the idea that their only security, their social security, is being threatened. We speak for millions of reasoning people fighting to preserve our environment from greed and from stupidity. And we speak for reasonable people who are fighting to preserve our very existence from a macho intransigence that refuses to make intelligent attempts to discuss the possibility of nuclear holocaust with our enemies. They refuse. They refuse because they believe we can pile missiles so high that they will pierce the clouds and the sight of them will frighten our enemies into submission. Now, we're proud of this diversity as Democrats. We're grateful for it. We don't have to manufacture it the way the Republicans will next month in Dallas by propping up mannequin delegates on the convention floor. But while we're proud of this diversity, we pay a price for it. The different people that we represent have different points of view, and sometimes they compete and even debate and even argue. That's what our primaries were all about. But now the primaries are over, and it is time when we pick our candidates and our platform here to lock arms and move into this campaign together. If you need any more inspiration to put some small part of your own difference aside to create this consensus, then all you need to do is to reflect on what the Republican policy of divide and cajole has done to this land since 1980. Now, the president has asked the American people to judge him on whether or not he's fulfilled the promises he made 4 years ago. I believe as Democrats we ought to accept that challenge, and just for a moment let us consider what he has said and what he's done. Inflation is down since 1980, but not because of the supply-side miracle promised to us by the president. Inflation was reduced the old-fashioned way with a recession, the worst since 1932.
When we look and we can see, things are not what they should be. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. When we look and we see things that should not be, God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Now here's a nice little chorus we've got. Eventually, hope you sing it with me. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Me and you. It's time to turn things around. Trickle up, not trickle down. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. See it? It's time. It's time to turn things around. Trickle up, not trickle down. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Now, here's that chorus again. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Me and you. And when drill, baby drill, turns to spill, baby spill, God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Try it. Yes, when bill, baby drill, turns to spill, baby spill, God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Sing it with harmony. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Me and you. Don't give up. Don't give in. Working together, we all can win. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give in. Working together, we all can win. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Now that harmony. Hope and we'll all hold. Hope and we'll all hold. Hope and we'll all hold through. Me and you. Problems to be solved, let's get everyone involved. God's counting on me. God counting on you. Yes, there's big problems to be solved. Let's get everyone involved. God's counting on me. God's counting God's counting on you. Harmony. In my hometown, 60 miles north, my wife and I have lived there 61 years now. Oh, you know, just 3 days ago, we had our 67th wedding anniversary. But I like to sing with kids. My own kids are grown up. When we sing with younger folks, we can never give up hope. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. When we sing with younger folks, we can never give up hope. God's counting on me. God's counting on me.
Now for something completely different.